When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And today we're talking about the It Books of April, the books that we think, or I guess I think, I picked 10 that are contenders to be the It Book of April. And then Rebecca helps me winnow them down. And by helps me, mean she does it herself, and I take no responsibility for how wrong or right the pick may be.
With occasional input, nudging, and a very occasional veto.
I will try to keep you from doing something really barbaric, let's put it that way, to paraphrase Orwell. I guess a couple programming notes. If you are interested in the Book Riot Podcast newsletter, one went out last night. Usually go up on Friday. I had a bit of a mess of a Friday, and I was like, you know what? I'm not going to do it late Friday night or Saturday morning. I'm doing it Sunday night for that Sunday night / early Monday wake up. There, trying a little experiment there. You can see a couple things. One is I had a really wonderful trip to Seattle with my family last week, the weekend before last. I don't know how you do this. We need
what
more
is time.
I'm sure the Germans have a word for 9 days ago. And we spent a good couple of hours at Elliott Bay Books in Seattle. And it got me thinking about, I think it's pretty close to my perfect bookstore. It's not perfect.
Oh, I love that.
And it let me think about what are the elements that go into my perfect bookstore, and I outlined them there. Elliott Bay lacks only one thing, and if you want to know what that is, go check out the email, and you can find a link in the show notes there. Other programming things? I feel like we've been recording so many shows. I don't know what's coming out next, what hasn't been released. Rebecca, help me remind people what to remind people.
We've been doing catch-up and recording ahead because you've been traveling and I will be at a conference for work next week. So let's see. Today we're talking about the It Books of April. Next week, this coming Monday.
See, you're doing no better than I do.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm time traveling. I'm trying to time travel here. Okay. So most recently on the Patreon, it's live now. We rewrote, talked about, weighed in with our opinions on Hollywood Reporter's 50 best TV shows of the 21st century. We both like television a lot. We talked about how prestige TV is kind of the literary fiction of the TV world. So we talked about our faves, what we thought the list did well, what we would have put on it, that kind of thing. You got the normal news show came out earlier this week. Today we've got It Books of April. There will be no bonus episode this week because I will be traveling
for
a conference. You're going to be doing the news with Sharifa later
this week,
recording later this week. She's back from parental leave, so we're glad to have Sharifa back in the mix. So you'll hear her if you're a patron. You'll hear her on Friday. If you're listening in the main feed, you'll hear her with Jeff on Monday. And then midweek next week, we're going to check in on Ripley, which all of that will drop on Netflix later this week. They're doing it in one fell swoop. I rewatched Talented Mr. Ripley last night. It holds up after 25 years. And we'll also be checking in on A Gentleman in Moscow. The first two of those will have been out by then. Maybe we'll also talk about Masters of the Air, some of the other adaptations we've been watching. And then at the end of next week, we're going to be bonus episoding our way through a book club about James by Percival Everett. So you've got time to pick up James and read it. If you want to book club that with us, that episode will come out on the 12th. So really fun lineup these next couple weeks.
I picked up a signed copy of James at Elliott Bay Books. Couldn't resist.
I'm jealous of that.
I was like, you know what? We don't really care about this, you and I, generally, the signed first edition stuff.
But the
you
Percival
make
Everett
an exception
special.
For an exception. Yep. Right. Let's do our first sponsor break, and then we'll get into the It Books.
Today's episode is brought to you by Greenleaf Book Group. No summer vacation should be without a great read, and I don't know about you, but I am partial to mysteries and thrillers for my hot month reads. It's hot girl reading summer, always over here. And from the award-winning librettist of Legally Blonde, the musical, and the screenwriter of Freaky Friday, Heather Hawk, comes the page-turning psychological thriller, The Trouble with Drowning. So when author Eden Hart floats into Tucson's Antigone Books in all her dazzling perfection to give a reading, Kat, a struggling writer, can't help but compare herself. Thankfully, Kat's life starts to take on its own Eden-like glow when her literary future takes shape and she falls madly in love with Jacob. As demons from her past begin to surface, Kat's mental health craters, and this halcyon dream slips through her fingers. For the fastest-paced, slow burn you won't be able to put down, be sure to check out The Trouble with Drowning by Heather Hawk on Amazon or your retailer of choice. And thanks again to Greenleaf Book Group for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have 7 great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number 6. So if he is to have 7 great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
Strong month, Rebecca. Strong month indeed. Mm-hmm. The way we do this, for the if this is your first It Books, is I present a title, talk a little bit why it's on the list, and then we decide if it survives the head-to-head matchup with the subsequent book. So the first book gets the easiest path to at least surviving once. I have to admit, monkey with the list in the ordering just to make it interesting, because there's a couple that if they appear early, make it less interesting. I think there is probably a pretty clear It Book of the Month this month, and it's going to come in the 10 hole. But let's talk about books before we get to that.
Okay.
So first up, I don't know how much cachet Ruth Reichel has anymore. Do you? She has a novel coming out called The Paris Novel, which it sounds like exactly what I want from a Ruth Reichel novel, which is about food, art, and fashion, the 80s in Paris. Because you know who was doing food and fashion and writing in the 80s in Paris? It was one Ruth Reichel. So do you even need to know the plot? You could probably guess. One-way plane ticket. Here we go. That's up first. What do you make of this?
That sounds charming. I didn't know it was coming out. I have not read any of Reichel's fiction, so I can't really weigh in on that side, but she is, of course, one of my favorite food writers. Maybe it's just because I'm coming out of having finally gotten on the Amor Towles train, but I'm imagining that Ruth Reichel in Paris in the 80s is kind of a similar vibe to an Amor Towles, like charming, breezy, but not insubstantial. That sounds like a good time on a spring afternoon.
I don't think... I'm not seeing in the publicity stuff for this if it's her first foray into fiction or not. She's the author of 5 food memoirs. And I got to say, by the time you've written 5 food memoirs, you probably have covered, you know, from beans to toast. So it's time to make some crap up.
I believe she's written some other fiction.
Maybe
but
she
I
has.
I have also not read that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's one called Delicious! Which would be a really funny idea for a musical that makes fun of foodies. Yeah, I will read this. I'm sure I will probably give this to at least one family member for a Father's Day. And you might guess what family member that would be based on the holiday there. Okay, that's up first. Looking forward to that. Next up.
Okay.
Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent by Judi Dench. So this looks like a memoir / appreciation / reason to tell some stories about playing Shakespeare characters by one Judi Dench. And if we had a separate It Books hierarchy for audiobook pick, I think this would crush. But I'm looking forward to this. It comes in at a svelte 400 pages, but there's a lot of illustrations. And
okay.
It looks like there's a lot of blank space and just sort of, it's going to be a nice gift book. I don't know. Yeah, I'm super curious. Dench is as beloved as an actor as there is. I was trying to think of who is more beloved, even on this side of the pond. Who do you take above Judi Dench for sort of warm and fuzzy feelings? I got nobody. I got
maybe
nothing.
Helen Mirren.
Nope. Sorry. Thank you very much for playing. It is not Helen Mirren, but you're in the right area. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I don't know that this is going to be a much, you know, this is not going to be a TikTok phenomenon, I wouldn't think. But if you're looking for, well, I guess it's going to be something upwards of 15 hours of erudite, charming, warm, and slightly naughty listening, which it seems to be Judy Dench's niche. Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent, against the Paris novel by Ruth Reichl for you, Rebecca.
I mean, the Paris novel is like such a search engine optimization win. It's a great title. I don't know. Judy Dench, super fun. There was that great viral clip of her a month or so ago from, I think it was the Graham Norton show, where she just like launches into Shakespeare because she is just walking. She's performed so much of it. She's just walking around.
Just it's all in there. There's a folio after folio in there. Yeah.
I think in my heart, I would like this one to knock out Ruth Reichl, but probably in practice, Ruth Reichl will surpass Judy Dench in it bookness. We might get some more like nice videos or audio excerpts.
Yeah, the tour will be Judy amazing. Dench. Really looking forward to the audio tour
The book club factor, which is one of the things we think about for an it book, is certainly higher for something called the Paris novel that is charming and is about food and really pitched towards a certain kind of reader. I feel conflicted about this, but I think I'm going to pass Ruth Reichl through to the next round.
I think that's probably fair. I'm calling it now. I don't know if they take bets over at Ladbrokes for who's going to win the Grammy for Best Audiobook Performance, but it always goes to a celebrity, and that would be a really great pick if you can get good odds on it. Not that I know anything about betting, nor ever bet on this. Okay, up next, The Cemetery of Untold Stories by Julia Alvarez, coming out April 2nd. From Algonquin, 256 pages, you love to see it. A writer who inherits a small plot of land in the Dominican Republic and decides to bury the pieces that she has not been able to finish in the graveyard. And then stuff happens. So I don't want to say more. I think this sounds cool to me. That's why it's here.
I'm into it. This sounds like an Alvarez twist on the real life thing Margaret Atwood did a few years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Return him to the trees.
In a forest somewhere that no one's going to read. Alvarez can make news. She has been a book club hit. This is interesting. And I do think there's potential for like a Reese pickup on something.
I totally agree with
like
you
on that. It's just a really good hook that like, I mean, I'm into the hook of like writer buries the stories that she doesn't like in general. But when you add in the surrealist element of like, and then stuff happens, whatever the stuff is, I think that's a fascinating read. I'm going to go with Alvarez here. Pass her through.
75,000 print run from Algonquin, which for them is, I'm sure it'll be their lead title of the spring into summer. All right. You have recently succumbed to the erudite, urbane charms of one Amor Towles.
I have.
Do you know who I was going to once I started saying that? Did you know where I was going?
Erudite, urbane. Got it.
Who else is there? Table for Two Fictions, which is a story collection and a novella.
Okay.
And the novella features a character from Rules of Civility, is what it looks like. So, on the one hand, you have between Lincoln Highway, Rules of Civility, and Gentleman Moscow, that is an unimpeachable threesome as you're likely to find coming of the gate. So, Towles has brand recognition. I guess that's my first point. People know who this person is among the kinds of people that would read a book like this, upmarket into literary fiction. On the downs, also on the upside, Gentleman in Moscow is out, and that's getting some buzz, and people really love these books. They're really wonderful. They're wonderful all-rounders, I would say, the Towles. Towles, gosh, I cannot do that right consistently.
It's Towles.
On the other hand, short story collection.
Now, Yeah, normally there would be a strike against it for being a short story collection, but the paperback of Gentleman in Moscow that I read had an excerpt of this in the back of it, and it said, like, it had a picture of the cover of Table for Two that clearly says fictions. Notable that it says fictions and not short stories. That's an interesting choice.
I like this. Is that going to trick us into reading short stories? It's like, I didn't notice the S on the end of this.
But then the copy above it says, read an excerpt of Amor Toll's next novel. And I was like, what are we doing here?
This is what, you love this. You love it when people obfuscate, prevaricate, and then generally
it's
are disingenuous about what people are reading.
When publishers aren't direct about what someone is buying. I mean, Tolles is a huge name. If anybody can make this successful, it's going to be a name of that size. And I have insider information from a bookseller friend that I was just telling over the weekend. Like, I finally got on the Amor Toll's train. It turns out that things people like are good, actually. And they told me that the pre-orders for this are off the hook. Yes. So at least in that bookstore. So either folks are genuinely excited about Amor Toll's short stories, or they're just excited about Amor Toll's and they have not realized it's short stories yet. This one might end up living in that zone of, like, a lot of people bought the book and fewer people read it when they realized they got tricked into buying a bunch of short stories. Maybe they'll actually read them. Everyone should read more short fiction. But I mean, this is Amor Toll's. I'm going to pass him through. I think he will defeat Julia Alvarez roundly here.
Yeah, I am looking forward to this myself. It's also strange because it's six stories and a novella, and it's 464 pages. So these are not short stories. So I think they are probably being sleight of handish when it comes to marketing here. But a 70-page story is kind of not a short story. It's also, yeah. I mean, that's what they're going to have to be.
It's like not quite a novel, but it's a big short story.
Yeah, it's very unusual. What that is, is an Audible original.
Yes.
Or a Scribd original or something like this. So I'm very curious. Would you like to talk a minute about The Pleasures of a Gentleman in Moscow for those of people coming new to both this world and Tolles's, I guess, you know, general mise en place, or what he does and how he cooks?
This is my only Tolles so far. Is it Tolles? Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Or Tolles? Tolles.
I think I've been as Tolles as Tolles. I thought I was corrected. Okay. Someone was very upset about this. We're going to call him AT for short. Big old AT.
Big old AT. Yeah, because we've got the... I remember when Rainbow Rowell was big that it was like Rowell for towel and rolling like bowling when we had her and Jake.
I still have to think about that one.
I need, we'll do the Google on AT here. So I've only read A Gentleman in Moscow. I kind of suspect that Lincoln Highway might be the one that really gets me on board because it's like on a road trip story.
Yeah, I think Gentleman in Moscow. Anyway, that's
it. Okay. It's just charming as all get out. Like, I don't know that I'm going to ever be a diehard fan of the old AT. There's just like not quite enough edge for my flavor profile in there. But it's, I think when you said erudite, that's right. Like, dude is dropping literary references left and right. But they're done in like a way that's not too highbrow. It's not snooty. There's like a real appreciation of language and the arts. There's a real warmth for the characters, a lot of humanity on the page. And the idea, like the setup of Gentleman in Moscow, where the count is like, his manor is burned down and he is made into a former person after the Great Revolution in Russia. And the only reason that he is not sentenced to death is that he wrote a poem, or a poem was published under his name that seems to position him as maybe siding with, being sympathetic to the revolution. So like, maybe you can stay, maybe we don't need to kill you. And so he has been living in an opulent suite in this Metropole hotel, and he is sentenced to spend the rest of his days in the hotel, but in like a very small 100 square foot room in the belfry. And he is a man who believes you should, you know, be cheerful at all times and a master of your circumstances. So he like makes the best of it and becomes friends with a, you know, plucky young girl. I think when anytime you're bringing in like a precocious child character, you lose some points for me on degrees of difficulty, because that's just like, if you do it well, it's easy and fun and everyone likes it. And there's a couple of those in the book. But I did really enjoy it. It was a nice way to spend the weekend. Having watched the first episode, I think Ewan McGregor nails the character with like the right, there's gravitas and warmth. Looks like the show is taking some liberties, making it like a little bit darker or raising the stakes in a way. But like one of the great pleasures of the book is that there are stakes. Like if he leaves the hotel, he will be shot. But he doesn't live, the character doesn't live in those stakes every day. Right. Like most of this is just this lovely community that kind of pops up around him. In some ways, it felt to me like 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas, but rather than like being contained in a neighborhood, he's just contained in this one building with these people. It's not nearly as zany as Marie-Helene Bertino, but yeah, though it was very pleasurable. I think I get it. Like, that's what I walked away from, is like, I get it why people love this, and in a way that makes me feel good about it. Not like sometimes you and I read a bestseller and we're like, oh, I get this, and it bums me out about the state of books, but I get it and I'm on board.
It also does the thing, and this is going to feel like the most cutting remark since, you know, Noel Coward was smoking cigarettes, but it's the kind of books that makes you feel smart for reading it, and not only that, for liking
that's a great point. Yeah,
and also that it's not hard to read. And that is a rare thing. We're in the Goodwill Hunting zone, and those kinds of things tend to do very well. I think this is, you know, this is an older person. I think a more literary person for sure. And there's a lot of past to that particular Rome. But if you can get people to feel like they're doing something that's good for them, and they get it, and it is entertaining on itself, that's kind of the triple crown for this kind of thing.
It's a great point. Like the references that the character drops to the books that he reads are the kind of references that like a general liberal arts graduate in the last 50 years are going to pick up. Many of them you would pick up from your high school English class.
That's some nice,
you paid attention, you get the reference, but it doesn't feel like homework, and it definitely doesn't feel like the author is lording his like special knowledge over you. Sometimes sometimes books can feel that way of like, oh, this reference is here to let me know that the author is smart. But this really feels like Toll's Tales. AT loves books, wants us to know how much he loves them. And he's sort of peppered that throughout.
Yeah. Okay. So that advances for now. Up next, in which I think is the first salvo from whatever we're calling Macmillan's tie-up with Leigh Bardugo. It's the familiar 500,000 print run plus stained edges. You can't see my air quotes here going on.
Thank you for sparing me.
No, that's the term of art. I would not have spared you. Trust me. I would really let you have it if I could. But I wanted to highlight. Side note. In New York Talking, you heard some of my thoughts if you listened to the last show about the state of publishing. One thing I didn't get to is the stained, stenciled, otherwise colored edges is coming to a special edition of the Bridgerton books. There's a special edition of Lord of the Rings. This is now becoming table stakes for a certain kind of book. Anyway, putting that to the side. So Bardugo, it's just stained. There's no image on the side of it, whatever. I don't care, except I find this completely fascinating, this whole, like, what haven't we done to books? Let's do something with the ends of the papers, and people will care. I couldn't care less myself. But having said that, this is historical fiction, and I do not believe it's not YA. This is for adults. There is a fantastical element, and we have not seen a breakthrough historical fantasy magic book in a long while. I was trying to think of the last one of these that we saw. And this is not my, this is not one of my primary genre, subgenres, even sub-subgenres, but I do like this kind of thing if done well. In the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell vein, I think that's the exemplar of this particular one of the last 25 years. And it seems like we're doing that in Spain, in the Spanish Golden Age. So it's not just, you know, going back to a familiarly, vaguely English time period. I guess that was set during the Napoleonic world, Susanna Clarke's novel. So it's not a home run for Bardugo, is what I'm saying. It's not a part of a trilogy. Yeah. It's not a YA situation. It is a stretch of the legs, which I give mad credit for. I think Bardugo is up there with one of my five or six most interesting people in publishing. that's maybe a episode we can save for later up there with Sanderson, because she has one of these tie-ups. She's not afraid to try stuff. She has a couple of hit series under her belt. And the hardest thing to do in books is to have one giant hit series. The second hardest thing is two. And she's had the Hellbent Ninth House version, which has done very well. But this is even zagging from that. She's zigged and zagged and zigged. So I'm endlessly appreciate this. I will probably read this. It is 400 pages. I was afraid when I saw this it was going to be like an 800 page, you know, situation.
Real potential there, yeah.
It is not. But so Bardugo's The Familiar, Rebecca. I offer
to you. Well, it's not short stories. So
yeah.
It has an edge over AT there. And the readers that, you know, first discovered Bardugo when they were young adult readers and she was first writing young adult fiction and fantasy have aged into adult readership. Her name carries a lot of weight. The cover of the book is like still kind of in the same vein of the, you know, like the color stories of her previous books. This sounds great. It sounds like it makes history fun. And then, of course, you get magic tossed in there. This one's tough because I think the AT is more likely to hit like the book clubby zone, but it's a huge print run from Bardugo. They know how to market her. I have a lot of faith in that. Macmillan is very invested. I'm going to go with Leigh Bardugo here.
I think that's probably smart. Is each of them have a little wrinkle that gives you pause. If this was Bardugo doing a YA trilogy kickoff, you'd be like, home run, I'm putting this at the end, no whatever.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's not romantic-y, which I have it's weird to say, but for one of these big authors to do this kind of thing is a bit of a risk right now. When I was putting this list together, I was looking at the Goodreads most anticipated list, and that's like this based on shelving. And you would not recognize the book industry. There are books there that I've never heard of and series, and it's all romantasy and fantasy. And it's not just the top of the chain that's doing well there. So anyway, that makes this a little bit... I pull for Bardugo anyway, but I am pulling for this one in particular, I think, because it's not that. Okay. You and I like a good, rompy, satirical, contemporary novel. And Justin Taylor's reboot sounds just like that, coming out April 23rd from Pantheon. A former child actor who is a deadbeat dad, recovering alcoholic, and video game voice actor, but he suddenly gets the opportunity for a reboot of his career. So it's about online culture, nostalgia, fandoms. Taylor wrote a really interesting short story collection called Everything Here is the Best Thing Ever.
Yes.
And he's written for The New Yorker, and you know, he's a writer, and he is, it feels like a little bit like a Andrew Sean Greer's Less turn that won the Pulitzer Prize, kind of in that same vein, which did pretty well. This is, I guess you'd be buying, if not low here, you're not using one of your top five draft picks if you're interested in picking this for one of Books of April, but I am very interested in it, and I think it's the kind of thing that could have a summer-like moment if it's good.
Yeah. That sounds great for summer. It's not going to beat Leigh Bardugo, but they're probably going to seize on the gift of good timing that is the Quiet on the Set documentary that's been going around with, you know, stuff about child actors and Nickelodeon and all of that. There's also, you can maybe ride the coattails of I'm Glad My Mom Died. This is in the water right now. Child actors like coming out, really talking about what the experience was like. And in addition to, like, I've seen a lot of cultural commentary about, like, the kids who were the first child influencers are becoming adults now, which is a wild thing to think about how time works. So I think there's some interesting hooks. If you were a publicist for this Justin Taylor book, you would have some interesting hooks to hang stuff on for what's happening right now. But, I mean, Leigh Bardugo, come on. So I'm glad you put this on the list. This is on my personal radar, but... I think even Justin Taylor knows he's not going to take out Leigh Bardugo.
Yeah, I did do a real shuffle for like the seven or so picks, so that just kind of got put in there. Next up, Real Americans by Rachel Kong. Really broke out with Goodbye Vitamin, 4 or 5 years ago? I'm not sure.
Pre-COVID, so who knows exactly when.
Yeah, so she is the family of Chinese immigrants and has a... I don't think it's... in this vein at all, but it's kind of a Mr. Gray Will See You Now moment, mm-hmm. where she enters into she gets married, I should say, to a billionaire, playboy, handsome person of the world. And then I guess we're going to jump forward. So we get their meeting, it sounds like, and then we fast forward when they have a kid who's a teenager. Things have not gone great. Yeah, this is literary fiction. It's Rachel Kong. It's Knopf. I know they're excited about this one. Mm-hmm. I will be talking to, I'm on the schedule to talk to Rachel about this book for first edition in a little while. Starred review in Publishers Weekly. I don't know that I need to tell you that much more about it. I mean, Kong is an emerging name in Big Five literary fiction. At this point. So what do you want to do with this? This is interesting. Bardugo versus Kong in here is very interesting.
This is tough. This is high on my personal list for April. Yeah. I really loved Goodbye Vitamin. I think there's, big celebrity book club potential for this. There's also big book award potential. This has the feeling to me of something that could end up on an NBA long list. Kong does really interesting stuff. There's a version of the world where Reese picks this up and this outsells Leigh Bardugo and becomes the conversation. I don't know how likely that is, but I am seeing a lot of marketing for it. It's also a tougher sell because it's literary fiction. That's hard. And Goodbye Vitamin was a slight, quiet little book, which is exactly the kind of thing that you and I love, but that doesn't have she doesn't have
PW calls this a fully fledged outing. This is 416 pages, so this is okay. This is,
it is a meaty novel.
You get your teeth sunk into this.
Yeah, interesting. Probably the smart money is Leigh Bardugo, but I would love to see Rachel Kong surprise me. I'll hold with Bardugo.
Sometimes it's hard. I mean, you can't pick which ones are going to be, but there is room out there for a Lessons in Chemistry, a Demon mm-hmm. Copperhead, a Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow.
Could happen.
These things do happen. And this is as likely a candidate as I think I see on the docket coming up for that. I think we should just say it. It's a book about Chinese immigrants and their descendants. And we've talked a lot about how the readers are still readers. And we have not seen the kind of support for authors like this, for a book mm-hmm. like this. We don't. Anne Napolitano is writing about a white family in Chicago. Lessons in Chemistry is about a white woman. It's just true. And unfortunately, I think there's a downdraft on this because of that reason. I think Knopf's going to do everything it can. Knopf's not going to do anything it wouldn't do for, I don't know, pick your author, right, that you want to put in here. But I think there is a resistance from a certain segment of the reading public for letting something like this fly. Now, having said that, Celeste Ng sells a lot of books and has sold a lot of books. So it's not impossible, but I just think it's harder. This is not a controversial idea that it's harder for writers of color to break out and reach that top stratosphere. It's harder for them to do everything. So of course it's harder for them to do this. And it's not fair and whatever. But mm-hmm. I think if we're doing the... If it doesn't happen for a why it wouldn't, I think you can't overlook that. Anyway. All right. Now we're to the where Jeff maybe needed to stack the deck a little bit.
I know where we're headed here, ultimately.
Well, actually, we have a bit of an interregnum because I do not know, much like I don't know what to do with the new Stephen King novel, I do not know what to do with the new Emily Henry novel. There's a new one coming out called Funny Story. I didn't even read the blurb. Didn't feel like I needed to. And that's not a knock. That's just she does what she does so consistently and so ably. I'm guessing this one is maybe set in the world where you're writing about comedy or improv or, I don't know, SNL, like the Curtis Sittenfeld book. It's commercial, romantic fiction that is pretty entertaining. And a lot of people like this and look forward to it. And there's one every year. What do we do with this? Do you want me to keep introducing this? I guess it's, we're going to do an April, May, or June every year. Do I put it to the side? What do I do with this?
I think that Henry, much to her own success, has entered the zone where it's an Emily Henry book. And Stephen King is a good example there as a very extreme version of it where you just know what you're getting. And even though Stephen King shakes it up quite a bit, there's a certain quality and type of writing that you're getting with Stephen King. I think that an Emily Henry release is becoming less exciting in publishing, probably because Romantasy is doing what it's doing, but like an Emily Henry release is less of a capital E event than it was a year ago. She's probably going to outsell Leigh Bardugo. Leigh Bardugo is still in the lead here, but I think there's a likelihood we will talk more about the Leigh Bardugo and what is it, the fourth or fifth Emily Henry book is less likely to get picked up for something like Reese's Book Club because the celebrities have all talked about the previous Emily Henry books. I could support just mentioning that there's an Emily Henry book or mentioning that there's a Stephen King book when we get to it books, but not putting them in contention because they're just so unlikely to actually become part of the conversation that is necessary to be an it book. So I'm going to go with Leigh Bardugo.
I think it's, I mean, again, it's helpful to remember the heuristic soup that we are drinking and sipping when we're talking about it books, which is it is a combination of things. You know, sales and name recognition. There needs to be something to say about it to some degree, or, you know, something to sink your teeth into. And sort of the point of a commercial fiction romance like this is that you don't really sink your teeth in. You might sink into it, but it's not with your teeth necessarily, if you hear what I'm saying. It has its own purpose, but you're not going to be blown away because you're kind of get what you expect. And that is the Faustian bargain you kind of make as a genre writer like this that does the same thing or operates within the same constraints and vibe every time. They all look the same because they all kind of are the same.
Yeah, it's like the point of Starbucks is consistency and predictability, and there's value to that. That's not a knock. Like, I don't want to get cranky emails about comparing genre fiction to fast food, but there is like, or, you know, the Hilton, like, you know what you're getting. And upmarket commercial romance is where Emily Henry lives. They're contemporary. People are going to talk kind of quick and bantery. Like, you know what you're getting. And especially in genre that relies on, you know, predictable tropes in which people really want to see those predictable tropes. That's the feature, not the bug.
That's right.
But it's those features make genre fiction less likely to land in it book conversation unless you do something where you shake up the tropes or you express the trope in a way that we haven't seen before. You're challenging it in some fashion. And Emily Henry is not doing that. She's delivering, and she's going to sell very well for as long as she continues to deliver on the thing that readers have come to expect from her. But that does make it, it's less interesting for conversation. Precisely because it's so predictable. I think she's probably just fine with her book sales.
I mean, it takes its own kind of skill to operate within the tropes and expectations of romance and to give something people new, and they don't close the book thinking, I'm kind of done with Emily Henry. That they're looking forward to the next one because of how she remixes and re-entangles. So I think if this segment were called the Notable Books of April, it would be a no-brainer to keep Henry books on here. But as an it book, I just, unless there's something real different, like unless she writes a historical fantasy, like if The Familiar had Emily Henry's name on it, now we're in an interesting territory.
Right. Then we're, what is this going to look like? Right.
Or if Bardugo's had her name on Funny Story, either of those things would be kind of fascinating. Actually, Bardugo's
like a Freaky Friday
would be kind of interesting to see. Yeah.
Commercial genre writers. Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good Patreon segment. Write that down. Freaky Friday authors. Authors we wish we would try the other author shtick.
All right. It's noted. Right. It'll happen.
You know, one contender. Oh, look at this. Eric Larson.
How about
the
that
The Demon
segue?
Of Unrest is coming out. Talk about working within dad book tropes, which also is a good Patreon episode. Write that down, the tropes of dad books. This is a saga of hubris, heartbreak, and heroism at the dawn of the Civil War. I think there may be an implicit strike against this when you have a subtitle that long, and it's not exactly clear what the story is. So this is about the 5 months between the election of Lincoln and the start of the Civil War, a slow-burning crisis. So this is less well-trod territory amongst extremely well-trod territory, I guess, these 5 months here. I mean, a great title. And when you're getting to use Lincoln quotes for your titles, you just get a head start. This is like your precocious juvenile thing. Using Shakespeare or Lincoln snippets as your title automatically gives you gravitas that you may or may not have earned. But having said that, it's one of the subs is a political horror story, which is a fascinating way of thinking about it. It is 592 pages, which, depending upon your disposition, may be a pro or a con. Eric Larson, who is 1A to David Grand's 1 in this particular niche of the market, I would say, tentatively. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm kind of thinking through it as I'm saying that. Anyway, that's The Demon of Unrest by Eric Larson, coming out April 30th from Crown.
That's interesting. Larson has had to get nichier and nichier as the dad book has become a thing. You know, it started.
But why?
With like,
why do we need? Why does he have to? Anyway, that's a different conversation.
Well, he is getting. Maybe he just started broad and he sold so well doing, you know, Devil in the White City and the book about the ships in a big storm. And it was like,
Yeah,
he's like, I've sold plenty of books and now I want to get nerdy. Let me go to this like 5 week stretch in the Civil War. Whatever he's doing here, I think he's having a great time. I don't know that the books are continuing to sell quite as well as the early ones did, but they are continuing to sell because a big nonfiction book with Eric Larson's name on the cover is going to sell well. It's like so solidly in the dad book zone, as you were saying.
That's true.
Also, like airport book zone, 590 is a hard sell if you're standing in a Hudson News, though. this will probably outsell Leigh Bardugo, and the long tail of it will be longer than Leigh Bardugo, but I don't know how much there is to say about it. Like, he'll be like, there'll probably be some NPR segments about the history here. For it bookiness, I think I have to stick with Bardugo for one more round.
I think that's fair. I think The Devil in the White City is dad canon. I mean, that book continues to sell extraordinarily well. That's the signal. I think the one that really made his bones.
It's like in the welcome, you're a dad now, either literally or spiritually starter pack.
It's also better than, I mean, it's also excellent in its own right. You don't.
It's very good. It
can transcend the large print one for the granddads out there. It clocks in at 880 pages. At which point I say, get a Kindle and use the larger font. That's going to be my move. I'm not going to be toting around large
pitch
print
for
books
audiobooks.
When I'm 65. Yeah, you can spend 40 hours or whatever you need to do there. 12 million copies in print for Eric Larson.
Okay.
All right. We're down to it.
Bring it home.
Knife by Salman Rushdie. My most anticipated book of the year that I know about, he said, with an uptalk at the end. The subtitle is A Memoir of an Attempted Murder. I mean, Jesus Lord, do you get any better than that for a hook?
And it's Salman Rushdie doing
and
it.
Yeah, and he's... this is a weird thing to say. I think he's underrated right now. I almost picked Rushdie for our underrated author situation. It felt silly.
You could have joined me in Hot Take Corner.
Yeah, I let you have the Hot Take Corner, which is the lukewarm take corner. That your lukewarm takes were so hot, they became hot. I don't know. You kind of... It did not obey the laws of thermodynamics of takes, how you were, what you were working
just
with there.
Stick with me, kid.
Yeah, that's right. You're going to go some places. Meditations After an Attempted Murder. This, of course, is Rushdie's account of enduring and surviving and recovering from... Not just the attempt on his life that happened, 3 years ago, but it sounds like it's going to wrap in the 30 years he's been living under the fatwa that was ordered against him. That is still in place, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, 272 pages, so it's neither slight nor ponderous. Feels like the right length for me. Rushdie Azance feels in the offing. Victory City, which was his last novel, I thought was terrific. I think he has an air of impenetrability around most of his works because they are, some of them are difficult. And the Satanic Verses, which has the most mind share, is quite difficult. And, you know, it's not Finnegan's Wake, but it's not Funny Story by Emily Henry either, nor is it meant to be either of those two things. But, yeah. I don't know where the Rushdie Nobel odds sit. You know, this would be an interesting time to take a look at this. In this era of book banning and censorship, Rushdie has had no more greater peril for longer than anybody. I this is the literary event of the year, as far as I can tell.
Right yeah.
Now. So this it clearly is going to go through. I'm not sure what else to say about it at this point.
Yeah, this is going to win, obviously. Like you, I don't. Yeah. I really try not to look at upcoming releases before we do these, so that I can come in fresh and be surprised. Right. And you always pick some titles that weren't on my radar anyway. But like, I have been looking forward to April.
Well, we talked about in the draft, knife. Right? In the winter or the spring draft.
Since last fall when they released the book cover and we were both like, oh my God, look at this book cover. This is going to be amazing. This has all the qualities of the It book. Mm-hmm. It's a big name. It's a big print run. It's a stunning subject. He will be all over doing press for this. There are going to be so many things to say about it, I imagine. And maybe this is because I'm in the middle of the new Hanif Abdurraqib and I'm thinking about nonfiction and memoir that... Like, is kind of recursive and discursive and like moves away from the original subject while still somehow magically being about the original subject. But my expectation here is that we get Rushdie talking about this most recent attempt on his life, Rushdie talking about the fatwa, and then also Rushdie just doing like broad consideration of culture stuff. Yes.
And world culture, not just parochial, yes. Like local school board 298 in Iowa, which is important,
right.
But that's pretty local.
Both of these attempts on, well, the fatwa and this literal murder attempt sit inside a really important, specific cultural context for why some people are very mad at him and have been very mad at him for the approach that he takes, the things that he writes about, the subjects that he takes on and what he has to say about them. And that was important 30 years ago, and it's important now. And I think he's going to have reflections about this. My expectation is this will be Rushdie's definitive statement about his body of work. I'd be very surprised if we ever got like a Rushdie writing memoir or just a like
he wrote
my
a
life
memoir
by Salman
called
Rushdie.
Anton something that was
Anton Chekhov, right?
Yeah, Anton. Was that what it was called?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the mashup it was doing. I was like, and it was a memoir of his life as a, kind of a reader, as much as anything. But I agree with you. I don't know that there's going to be My Life by Salman Rushdie, like a presidential biography,
or like a 900 page situation.
Yeah,
like
it doesn't seem. And frankly, I don't want that from him. I want from nonfiction. No, I want this book and then fiction because he is a grand master.
He doesn't seem terribly interested in just like, you know, doing the razzle dazzle jazz hands of like, I'm Salman Rushdie.
Not anymore. He had a time. He did.
right.
He's done razzle dazzled. He was in Bridget Jones' Gyre. I mean,
that's true.
Talk about
that's
a documentary
true.
I would like to see in the Jean Le Carré, Joan Didion vein. Let's get a Netflix Salman Rushdie sit down. He's got the eye patch. He looks amazing. I mean, I'm sorry he has to wear it, but like.
Yeah, he's like willing to play with his fame.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem terribly interested, or he hasn't until this, in just like telling his story.
Right.
And this, you know, this like most recent murder attempt brought back a theme, I think, that gave him a hook and a reason to like to dive into all of this stuff. It was like this and James by Percival Everett were my like or are my most anticipated books of this year, at least until we start hearing about what's in the fall lineup.
What could come out in the fall that contends with either of those?
Right.
I can't even imagine what it would be.
It would have to be very exciting, and I don't know what it would be.
Yeah, I don't know what it would be either.
It's pretty rare also to be sitting on April 1st with like a very strong sense of what our favorite books of the year are going to have been. But yeah, this one is a very big deal for sure.
Yeah, Rushdie, I mean, we joke about the most interesting man alive, and I think Rushdie has to be in your top five draft picks if you're actually doing that particular game.
Totally.
Men or women or non-binary, we'll throw. Most interesting person alive. And again, not uncomplicated past, and time has gone past, and I have even forgotten what I remembered that I'd forgotten about his personal lives and his own interactions with the press and women in his life, and there's a lot there. And it's all worth an examination, I think, at this point, because also not for nothing, and this matters, one of the all-time book covers. I'm willing to put it up with any book cover I've ever seen.
If you 100%. Have not seen it, it's a great cover.
It is just the word knife in a very, you know, elegant uppercase serif font, but the eye is a slash that looks like it's cutting through the paper, just a complete vertical slash on just basically a cream-colored background. As an effective and jarring and evocative cover as I has ever seen, and a real testament to less is more, and it's sort of like, I don't know, almost a Rothko, Richard Serra, just do something and do it extremely well and let it be. Anyway, so I can't imagine I will see a better book cover. Again, sometimes when the content is both known and visceral, it does a lot of the work for you, but then you just leave well enough alone. So anyway, have I ever talked more about a book cover than I did just then? That's not usually that's not usually one of my wells that I get water from. But.
It's a great cover, and hard to imagine being disappointed by this one.
How could that even happen? I mean, everything can go sideways. That's
sure.
true, but a pretty high floor for this.
In the like one of the ways that I know I'm really excited about a book, and not just excited, but that I have a high confidence level for it, is if I'm willing to pre-order. And
did
how
you?
Far out I'm oh yeah. Yes. And I pre-ordered this one like as soon as it became available for pre-order, because I want to have it in my hot little hands. Like, you know, reading a physical book is also not a thing I do all that often anymore. But I want to have this one. I will stick it on the bookshelf. That cover. I mean,
cover out, baby.
And it's just, it's really hard to imagine that even if the book is not what I'm expecting it to be, it will be a high value reading experience. I have a lot of faith in that.
Even if it's watered down, which would be a shock, that would be interesting to talk about.
Yes, that would be a shock, and it would be definitely worthy of conversation.
Yeah, my version of pre-ordering is, which is special book, is that I don't pre-order it. I usually pre-order stuff I'm worried that I may forget about a little bit, but is that I don't even need to remember to walk to Powell's on Tuesday and buy it. Because that itself is
pleasurable.
Yeah,
you have your nice ritual there.
I have my little ritual. I go down, usually after my calls are over, it's like 1 or 2 in the afternoon before the kids are home. I've kind of got what I need to get out of the way, because I'm on the West Coast and so much of our, well, our company is like kind of like weirdly 7 to 2 Pacific is when it's the most crackling. And at 2, I have a little bit of a break. Sometimes I take a nap. But on a notable new release day for me, it is a walk to Powell's, pick it up. And, you know, that's part of it. So that's the definition for us of an It book. I think it will be the It book of the month. I think it will be contention for It book of the year. If you had to guess right now, also a good Patreon episode at the halfway mark, let's guess our notable books of the year. Like, which books would you have high degrees of confidence appearing on? I think the list that I find the most descriptive of the year is the New York Times 100 Most Notable Books of the Year list.
Yes.
If I look forward to anything,
it's the one I look forward to.
I think that's the one that is trying to do kind of both plaudits, but also some historicity about what the year was.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be an interesting game to do. We should look at, you know what we could do? We could look at what day it came out last year. And we could do maybe even a couple episodes of the Patreon or bonus episodes trying to guess the 100.
Oh, yeah.
How close do we get?
I have some like books of the year so far stuff slotted in for the summer, like a halfway mark. And then we're going to do some National Book Award predictions when those are slated for later in the year. But yeah, I think notable books of the year guessing would certainly be fun for the winter.
I feel like the 100 notable, it's almost, if you get, I don't know, I don't even know what a good result would be. But if you got like, say, 60 of them.
Oh, man.
That would be pretty good, but because the prizes can be so random, like you're down to 12 or so, I mean, there's probably a few dozen, and it's 3 people. Where the 100 notable, the Times, I guess what I'm trying to say is the New York Times has a better sense of the year of books than anyone else, including especially like the 3 people that give out the Pulitzer Prize. They have to. They do it for a job,
casting,
and they do it all the time.
They're casting a much wider net for what made a book part of the conversation, and why should it be part of the conversation. There's always some surprises, but not a ton on that 100 most notable. And they do span, you know, like kind of poppy commercial fiction that became a big deal all the way into like serious nonfiction Pulitzer contender kinds of stuff.
That's right.
We'll incorporate some of that.
We'll try to figure something out there. All right. Thanks so much, Rebecca. That's It Book of April.
Always fun.
Find the link in show notes, bookriot.com/in. If you know definitively how to pronounce AT's name, I'm sorry, publicist, that may or may not be listening out there. I'm now into the zone with this where like the word inconvenience, I know that I spell it wrong, but then I can't remember if the way I think I spell it is the wrong way or the corrective to my wrong way. So I'm through the looking glass with the pronunciation here. We're going to try to get it right. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
All right. Y'all have a good one.